back around with So I want to welcome everybody here this evening, and so my name is Peter Trubowitz. I teach at the International Relations Department and direct the U.S. Senate here. And tonight's lecture is sponsored by the IR Department. And it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Beth Simmons. So I'm going to say a few words about Beth, and then I'll just turn it over. What's that?
Take as much time as you would like.
Okay, well, she massages the data. So Beth is the Andrea Mitchell Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. And before joining UPenn, she was, for many years, she taught at Harvard, where she was the Clarence Dillon Professor of International Affairs, and also the director of the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs. She has, as will be evident tonight, very wide-ranging interests in international political economy and international law. She's the author of two major university press books, seven edited volumes, dozens of journal articles, book chapters. Both of her books, her solo author books, have won major awards, and in one case, the American Political Sciences Science Association's coveted Woodrow Wilson Award, won the same award twice, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's a first. Is
I think so.
Anyway, it's pretty, that's a real hat trick. You don't even need three for that. So her accomplishments inside, outside, the classroom, they're really too numerous to kind of cover, but let me just say a few things about her, because it really is impressive. I mean, she's won most, if not all, of the professional awards available to international relations scholars. I looked at it, and I gave up after a while, but I think that's pretty accurate, close to me. The member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, has received grants and fellowships from Guggenheim, from the Smith Richardson Foundation, the Center for Advanced Study of Behavioral Sciences, Social Science Research Council, among others. She's a former president of the International Studies Association. She's also one of the field's tireless workhorses, having served on numerous editorial boards, advisory boards, and selection committees over the course of her distinguished professional career. I could go on, but you get the picture. She's like an outstanding scholar and really one of the field's great public goods providers, international relations, public good providers. And last but not least, she's really part of the LSC family. I just learned this on the way over here. So Beth did a Fulbright scholarship that she took here at the LSC. Were you in the IR?
International history.
Well, we like that one. So that's good. So we're delighted to host your talk this evening. It draw on some of the current research on GPA, a global performance assessments, and their role as kind of informal governance mechanisms in international affairs. It's a special treat for me because we've known each other for many moons. I'll just leave it like that. So you see what the title of the talk is. Beth, the floor is yours. Welcome back to the LSE.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks a lot for coming out tonight. And thanks a lot for participating in audience participation, as you did. You'll see why. As the talk goes on, I'm sure it's so low tech, you know, pieces of paper and counting up while on my knees using Excel. But you normally would use a clicker or something like this, but that takes a lot of registration and so forth. So we did it low tech, but hopefully it'll make an interesting point. And I'm interested in this area of global governance. When we think in international relations about how political entities influence one another, a lot of times we're thinking about military power, and we're thinking about economic power, we're thinking about sanctions, we're thinking about negotiations and pressure and that type of thing. And one thing that I think we're starting to pay a lot more attention to is the role of that information from a variety of sources is starting to make in the area of international relations and global governance. So we always knew that information was important. There's no doubt about that. All of our models of international affairs, talk about what kind of information the actors had available. Game theory certainly depends on assumptions about information, various kinds of theories of cooperation between states make very clear assumptions or assertions about what states know or think about each other. But I'm not talking about information of that kind of sort of centralized nature. Instead, what I'm talking about here is the creation and deployment of informal types of information. Not necessarily revealed by another state, although it could be, but information that nonetheless has a really, really important impact on states' reputations and hypothesis on the choices that states make. So that's what got me sort of thinking about how the information environment has changed over time. And all you need to do is to really kind of go to the internet and you'll find all kinds of sources on information about states. And surprisingly, one of the things that you'll notice is how much data has proliferated with respect to what we know about states, but not only what their GDP per capita is or what their trade deficit is, but also what the quality of living is, whether they do sustainable development, the well-being of their people broadly defined. And these are concepts which are contestable. GDP per capita is also contestable, of course, by the way, but these ones are really contestable. What even constitutes quality of living? And the interesting thing is that I want to show you and discuss with you tonight is there's actually a lot of contestation over how to measure the qualities that increasingly people are interested in about the way that states are designed, the way they behave, their policies, their qualities, how it is to live there, how people experience life in these states. And what I'm going to try to argue tonight, at least create a little bit of evidence for, is to think about ways in which these grading systems might be affecting outcomes and might be affecting choices that states make. It's a hard, hard case to make because showing somehow that action is based on certain pieces of information is not trivial. It's really very tricky to show that. So what I focus on here and what you will see if you go to websites and look under these various kinds of indicators is that there's a huge variety, increasingly. So this just gives you a smattering of the kinds of things you can see if you go to websites and try to sort of look up the various ways in which states have been graded over the last several years. So this just sort of gives you kind of a general idea here of what some of these websites look like, how they're presented, and the kind of information you can find. Lots of different possibilities here. I mean, one is you see information displayed really graphically in map form. How's life in various states? You see that one with the little palm trees that can go up and down. So palm trees reflect high quality of life. These can be manipulated, actually. So if you were to change some of the assumptions in the model, you can make the palm tree go up if you wanted to weight things a little differently. But this is the recommended weighting of the palm trees according to the OECD Better Life Index. Sustainable Society Foundation, they create information by states, but then they also provide you with these wonderful interactive maps where you can look around the world and you can see here, this one in particular is looking at sustainability of the environment, and you can see that Canada's doing great, they are the greenest. But then in terms of sustainability of the environment, you can see that there's a lot of variation around the world. Commitment to Development Index is another example. These are just sort of ways of competitiveness ratings that states have. Global Opportunity Index. These are ways that states have been placed in competition with other states. And then this information is made public, it's disseminated, becomes part of the public discourse. Question mark, does it affect what states actually do? So that's kind of what this project is involved with here. We decided to call this tendency global performance assessments. These are reporting routines that states, intergovernmental organizations, non-governmental organizations, and sometimes private actors use to attract attention to the relative performance of countries or other organizations in a given policy or performance area. Now, there are many ways you can assess performance, but the kind of criteria that we're using is we're really only talking about performance assessments that are regularized. So perhaps they're done semi-annually, perhaps they're done every 5 years, perhaps they are done every year, but they're done on a regular basis. We're really only interested in thinking through what the consequences are for these GPAs and these rating systems that are made public. So today I won't be talking about information that you must purchase or that is behind a pay-per-view firewall. Instead, I'm going to be talking about information that's made freely available to anybody who wants to have a look. In fact, a lot of these websites invite you to download it and play with it. Okay? So public information. And you'll see why that's important, because I'm going to be developing a theory, basically, of thinking about how this information makes its way into public understandings of states and their behavior, their nature, etc. The third point that we include is inclusiveness. So we have excluded from what I'm going to show you in a few minutes indicators that only take in just a country or two or a very small range of countries. We're trying to look here at indicators and ranking systems and assessments that in principle are very broad, taken in a lot of states. They're not all exactly global, but many of them are, and most of them aspire to be global anyway. Very importantly, the fourth thing that I think is important about this kind of a rating system is that they are purposive. I want to draw a distinction now between many other projects that exist that talk about how inaccurate, how unfair GDP per capita data is. And I want to focus instead on the creation of data which is intentionally designed to make an agenda, to create standards, and to try to hold states to it. So they're very purposive. They're trying to change something. They're trying to. It's really more of an advocacy instrument than it is a measurement instrument per se. And how do we know this? It's a murky line in some cases, but actually it's not that difficult because you can see the way they're packaged. When you can move the palm trees, when you can interact with these maps and make easy comparisons, when you can hit the sort button, think like that, and it'll show you who the top 10 are, and it'll show you who the bottom 10 are. We know we are in the world of public relations, right? We're not just in the world of measurement, okay? So purposiveness, I think, is evident in the way that the indicators are actually packaged. And then finally, and this one's very important too, to some degree, all of the indicators that I'm looking at in this project are comparative. Now, there are a number of ways in which they can be comparative, but they are all comparative. Ranking systems are obvious ways. So ranking takes every country from top to bottom, 1, 2, 3, 4, down to 190. They can also be rating systems, good, fair, poor. Okay? And I'll give you an example of a system like that a little bit later. They can also be systems that purposively create labels that are meant to stigmatize. So unfree, when you look at free amounts of data. They categorize explicitly free, partially free, and not free. And it's very clear, not free equals not good. Okay? And then finally, also, there are some instances in which these assessments create what we might think of as blacklists, and they truncate states or truncate other entities, and they truncate them into acceptable and not acceptable. The implication is that the social group is meant to sanction or at a very minimum think of as being on a watch list those who are below the line, and so that is what we would call a very kind of strong set of into, is really bifurcated, really, in which a state would be among in an unacceptable category by the standard of the group who's creating the rating system. Okay? So that's what we're thinking about here in terms of global performance assessments. By the way, when I say we, I should have gone back to the first slide in which I should acknowledge that all this work I'm doing has been, I've been working on it with Judith Kelly, who is at Duke University in the Stanford School of Public Policy, and we've been working on this together, and we have a newsletter with other people involved, but she's very much done the work behind a lot of what it is I'm going to be saying here tonight. So this sort of gives you a sense of how these have grown over time. So if we were to use that definition I just gave you and put one additional restriction on it, and that is where a state is a target, this is what you would see over time. This is what we were able to find. Okay, so we spent a lot of time digging and digging and digging, and by the criteria we set up, this is roughly speaking how the numbers have increased over time. And you can see it taking on right there in the mid-90s and early 2000s. So in the broader project we're working on, we think about assessment regimes more generally, not necessarily just targeted at states, sometimes targeted at international organizations, sometimes targeted at cities, for example. The Green Cities Index is one example of something like that. But what I'm going to talk about today primarily has to do with rating and ranking systems, GPAs, that focus explicitly on states. Why this drive to measure, rate, and rank? And you know, the truth is, I don't know. I can only speculate. I don't like to claim I know something when I don't have any evidence to prove it. But it seems to me like there might be at least three things at play that seem to have converged right around the 1990s. The first is democratization. And this, I think, has something to do with the collapse of the former Soviet Union, the opening up of new parts of the world to new demands for accountability. Also, the democratization wave in Latin America, where accountability, again, turns out to be a very important item, both in the development world and the human rights world, too, for example. Growing demands to know what governments are doing, what they're up to. And I think that is linked with the 1990s wave of democratization, creating demands for accountability. But I think in addition to that, globalization has definitely added something here too. Globalization has created a competitive environment where states and other units have to do the best they can to try to compete for whatever it is they want in the world, be it international business, be it investment, be it trade, be it status, be it kudos. These are all things that states might appreciate, okay, having. And the world out there is getting increasingly competitive, which, again, sort of drives a market for some of these indicators. And then third, I think one reason this is occurring is because it's possible. And that is that information technology has changed. It is no accident that this confluence is occurring at a time when the internet is taking off as well. Because as we will see, and as I have found with interview material, that those who create these kinds of assessment systems, the graders love to try to get as much notice as they can and promulgate their rating systems via all kinds of newer technologies, to include the internet, to include social media, Facebook, et cetera. So technology has really reduced the barriers to entry in this area. You know, it used to only be this was something that the IMF or the World Bank could afford to do, and now Walk Free, I don't know if you've heard of this organization, one guy basically could bankroll a global slavery index. So it's, you know, you have a concern, you have an issue, you now have the technology to possibly put out your idea of what states ought to be judged on. And that, I think, opens up not only this competition to do better in this competitive environment, but it also, I think, opens up the possibilities for contestation. And so as we kind of go through some of these indicators, it's, I think, not difficult to pick out the ways in which development has morphed into other things. So it starts out as a development indicator. human development. No, sustainable human development. No. Women's human sustainable development. You know, so it's getting, what I'm saying is, every time there is an alteration to an indicator or competition with the indicator, we ought to be thinking contestation. We ought to be thinking someone wants to change the global agenda, wants to change global discourse, and eventually wants to draw attention to things that are not being attended to in their opinions. So the result is here, I think, that more actors are developing and deploying these systems of global performance assessment as strategic forms of information politics than has ever been the case before. So I think that helps a little bit, this sort of helps a little bit to understand that upward swing. It's interesting, too, to see where these GPAs it should be, global performance assessment. At an earlier iteration of this, I was calling it global performance indicators, but I've changed it more broadly to assessment. It's interesting to see where they fall, what issue areas. And I think the idea of thinking about, again, about a lot of these coming out of globalization, we can see that a lot of them are economic, a lot of them have to do with development. When we think of them coming out of demands for accountability, we can see that a lot of them have to do with governance. A few have to do with human rights, not that many, but we can see that they, roughly speaking, reflect the kinds of possible explanations that are behind this kind of convergence. So this is sort of gives us a sense of how they fall by sector. And just to pull out a few examples, I'm working on an edited volume right now, and this just sort of gives you a sense of some of the indicators that people are doing very in-depth research on right now. The targets here differ because, as I was saying, the previous data I was showing you is focused on states as targets, but the book we're working on is more broad and more general. So we have, of course, the World Bank using these ease of doing business indicators to target states, but we also have, for example, in this book that we're doing, we have, for example, IGO performance indicators in which states, I'm doing the second one from the bottom now, have created assessments of international organization performance. Well, now that sets the international organizations in competition with each other for aid from states, okay, for participation by states. So these are some of the interesting examples that that this other project kind of focuses in on here. One thing we tried to do is to figure out whether there's really very much attention to a lot of these indicators. So, you know, we came up with 160 or so global assessment regimes, and I think we all should be wondering, come on, these can't all matter. And I honestly can't imagine that they're all effective, or that they all have influence. When you think of the cacophony of information out there, you know, so much more weight is going to be on the nature of the source, right? Where it's coming from, how credible the indicator is. Well, one thing we checked just at first was to see, you know, sort of how much binging around the internet, how much mention on the internet we had for all of these indicators, was 160. You cannot read this, of course, but what we did was line up every indicator we have, and just to give you kind of a sort of rough sense, first I have to tell you that it excludes S&P publicly available credit ratings, because that was 1.7 billion hits, way too many to put on this graph. And it also excludes 20 indexes that have fewer than 1,000 hits, but we were able to find them on the internet. This gives you sort of a rough sense. This is a logarithmic scale on the vertical scale. So, you know, really this is going way up. And the ones to the right are really a lot more than the ones on the left. But this sort of gives you a sense, when one could look through and kind of look at all these things you can't read, and get a sense of what are people paying attention to. The Corruption Perceptions Index by Transparency International is a surprise. To me, it's sort of a surprising amount of attention, given that Transparency International doesn't have resources to sanction or anything of that nature. Freedom in the World by Freedom House gets a good amount. And then there's ones down here on the end, are things like the Child Friendliness Index. There's one I can read it for you, the Global Militarization Index. You know, they just don't really get very much attention. And so one interesting thing to ask is, why do some of these get such wide attention and others of them not so much so? One possibility is it matters who creates them. And so we started to look at who creates these global assessment regimes, and it turns out that a lot of these are created by non-governmental organizations with very small resources. And yes, this fits the idea of low barriers to entry, but it also raises the issue of how much impact some of these new, not very well-resourced, non-governmental organizations, whether they can have credibility with any of these indexes or not. About 40 of them have to do with, are made or created by intergovernmental organizations. And then, you know, some of them, 33 of them that we came up with out of 160, were by private organizations. And these, a lot of them are by consulting agencies who dangle some kind of grosser or aggregated indicator out in front of people on the first page of their website. And then it turns out, to get any better information than that, you need to pay them to do the research. But we counted them because they do have, you know, kind of a front page of an aggregated index that they make publicly available. So that's what a lot of academic and private universities participate. We did not count things that universities groups have created primarily as research data. So if any of you, you know, you might be familiar with the Polity 4 data, which political scientists use all the time. That was not created to make countries more democratic. It's not packaged that way. It never was. It has a long history of primarily being rooted in a research tradition, and we don't count it here. Freedom House is different. It has a different history. It has a different purpose. It purposely markets in a very public way its data. And so so that's why, that's how we try to create some of these distinctions. I feel we couldn't tell. Even though we looked all around a website, or and some of them overlapped. Maybe a think tank in cooperation with a non-governmental organization. And some are created by states. There's only one state that we could find that does this, where states are the target. And that is my country, the United States of America. So we feel entitled to go to travel the world, gathering information, making judgments, trying to influence policy. And so a minority of these, all centered in the U.S., are also created by states. We're trying to influence governments to take certain policies. I should also say, though, that the U.K., we have some data that the U.K. has put out there. U.K. has... I forget the name of the index right now, but it has a very important index that is used to judge international organizations' effectiveness. And that's actually a very influential GPA. It's just that states are not the targets, international organizations are, and so it doesn't figure in here. Okay? So that gives us a sense of who creates these, and now where they come from. In that database, we have 160 or so. The United States did about... I don't mean the United States. I mean the headquarters of the organization that created the GPA centered in the United States. This includes the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, okay? So those aren't the United States. This is headquartered in the United States. And then you get 13% headquartered in the UK. You can see Switzerland, Germany, France kind of a little lower. You can see the Global South produces maybe 5%. So this is a situation in which the wealthy are basically judging the poor. In particular, a situation in which the United States is judging the organizations based in North America are judging the rest of the world. So, by the way, of course, this doesn't, because it's sort of not global, it doesn't include any EU-generated, unless they are global, okay? So, but if they're only EU indicators, they're not included, because in principle, these have to be global, not regional, right? So that gives you a sense of where they come from. And then it's interesting to ask, how do they do their job? How are they set up? Very interestingly, we find that almost half of these, are set up as zero-sum ranking systems. Zero-sum meaning you do not get to go up or improve unless someone else goes down. And so that's a hyper-competitive way of thinking about comparing. About 49%, a little bit more than that, because this big section of some combination includes ranking, and includes as well maybe some other sort of forms of categorizing. So maybe they draw lines which proceeds in categories once they rank them. Actually, that's very insidious, because if you have a ranking and then you have a category kind of embroidered on top of it, and then you think about the states that are just below, they might try to do almost anything to jump above that line. It might not be the most healthy public policy choice, but they might be hugely incentivized to try to make some kind of change, which pops them into the next category. So that's just one thing to sort of keep in mind. Very few blacklists, very few watch lists. They do exist, though. One is in the area of money laundering, with the Financial Action Task Force, which is centered in the OECD, which puts states on a blacklist if they are non-corrupt. They actually did use to call it a blacklist. They backed away from that. Everybody still calls it a blacklist. And that is, those are jurisdictions who are not cooperating in trying to clamp down on money laundering. And I'm going to give you another example of a watch list a little bit later on in this lecture. And that is the case of what the United States does in trafficking in persons as well. Okay, but this sort of gives you a sense just about the lay of the land, how they step up. You sort of, and this, I think, also helps us understand motive as well. When you see almost half involved in zero-sum ranking, you know that one of the main purposes of doing this is what? It's a generally competition, isn't it? I mean, if you're a ranking, you really are saying, there, compete. Right? You're asking them to compete. So this is our performance. So just kind of going through a few of these. Sustainable Society Foundation. Look at this one, you know, there's a horse race. You know, Denmark's always at the top. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Scandinavians, they just have this game nailed. I mean, they're the kinds of places that tend to score very high on very good indexes. U.S. is kind of, you know, depends. U.S. really moves around based on what it is you're measuring. You know, if you're measuring all indicators, for example, the United States is really quite low for as rich as the country is. But anyway, this sort of gives you a sense. And here, again, is one of the Global Opportunity Index, where, again, we can sort of look at the world and sort of get a sense on how various countries in the world rate on how well they're attracting foreign direct investment. Social Progress Index, again, kind of another basic sort of mapping schema here, comparison. Here's a picture again of the palm trees going up and down with the OECD Better Life Index. See on the far right hand side those little buttons that are, have a little red, little colors behind them. You can pull those across and get you really, really value civic engagement. More than anything else, you can pull that one far over to the right and the palm tree of the country that has good civic engagement will float to the top, and you'll see all this recalibrating going on. Okay, so some of this is, you know, we might consider to be data, but some of it is clearly meant to compare countries. And by the way, to make them pay attention to the items that are in the sub-index that comprises the overall index itself. So what role do performance assessment play around the world? They certainly exist. There's no denying that they certainly exist. But are decision makers or organizations somehow influenced by these ratings, assessments, and comparisons? Under what conditions and through what mechanisms might we expect these things to matter? I mean, is it simply a curiosity? I kind of go back and forth on this, because sometimes I think it's a fad and a curiosity, and sometimes I think kind of this is kind of a fundamental new way to do information. So, I don't know. I'm still wondering what the answers to this question are. What might be the consequences intended and unintended? So sometimes, you know, you might sort of set up an assessment regime that has consequences that you did not expect or were not intending. So, why might a GPA have some consequences? First of all, one thing is that they really take something that's complex and make it easy for people to understand. So this feeds into demands for information, information to form judgments to create political demand. political demand potentially to alter policy choice. But it depends. It is a kind of very bottom-up way to think of it. But you know, if you can simplify reality in a way that's favorable to a certain kind of a policy outcome, you might very well be able to tip political demands just enough in order to influence policy outcomes. So simplifying that complex reality is really, really important. People don't read really long reports. They just don't read them. And so, you know, no matter how good the deep and highly contextual evidence is, it's very hard to get policy to actually be created on complexity. And sometimes it's just much easier to turn to what do we need to do in order to improve. They constitute social judgment, and I want to be very clear about this. Sometimes, you know, when I think this is data, I think of data as unprocessed facts, broadly accepted unprocessed facts. How many hours a day does a village have water? I would put that in the fact world, okay? But if you're talking about a quality of life index, do we include water? Do we measure it in hours? Or do we worry more about the quality? Or do we want to include health instead of water, or food along with water? Or are there qualities of water that are even more important than the quantity of water? These are social judgments, and they are very, carefully, I think, honed and fed into this process of creating indicators. And this allows for agenda setting. And this allows for not just a government alone to say what constitutes good behavior, but instead to sort of ask, to be able to sample a broader social community outside the state about what they think constitutes appropriate or good behavior as well. Very importantly, I think these GPAs can have consequences by stimulating these comparisons. They can trigger reputation concerns. They can trigger status concerns among individuals in an organization. And this can happen at a lot of levels. So it's not when I say states care about their reputation. You know, it could be the environment minister who doesn't like the fact that they are rated 120. And it makes that minister look somehow incompetent. When he goes to a meeting of ministerial peers, he is face to face with others who know that data and may be judging his or her reputation. So I don't mean to just say states have reputations, although they may, but the people in charge of these policies have reputations as well. And we can think of it on a kind of domestic political level. Polities or constituents, they care that they come from a country. For example, I come from a country with very high gun violence. Does not make me feel good. You know, especially when I travel the world, talk with other people, and you know, they sort of say, "Wow, the United States is so dangerous." It doesn't feel good. Hurts my reputation. You know, it doesn't hurt my reputation. It makes me feel as though my country is suffering a poor reputation, and that could very well again bolster and provide additional support for making domestic demands for change. It's possible to do better, is what some of these comparisons say, right? It's not necessary that we have this kind of violence. So it triggers these reputational and status concerns of individuals and organizations, social groups, and among social groups. So within the United Nations, states compete and have reputational concerns and status concerns. And it fosters these competition dynamics. And I want to insist that these competition dynamics are both material and tangible, and intangible and non-material. So competition dynamics can be unleashed when you have a rating over how attractive a site you are for foreign direct investment. You know, there's clearly a concern for that foreign direct investment to be sort of tipped off. This is a good place to invest. So the fear is if you score low on something like this, that you may be foregoing potential investment. Another possibility is that some of these indicators are tied with international aid. So not markets, but policy. And this is the case with some of the, many of these indicators are actually part of the Millennium Development Goals. And the Millennium Development Goals, you have to score above the median for Millennium Aid eligible states in order to receive the aid. Again, that puts a lot of weight on how you're doing comparatively above the median. You know, that creates competition in a very different way. And tangible, I already, intangible, I already sort of mentioned. Intangible, why would any state sort of care about you know, how they do on these scores? And in an intangible sort of setting, and I guess I don't know exactly, but I would say that for whatever reason, countries keep putting up their gold medal counts during the Olympics. You know, there's nothing tangible involved there. It's a status thing, right? Maybe, I don't know if they do that here, but in the U.S., it's just a bar going all the way up. Yeah, I guess I'm doubting that. You know, I'm doubting that Namibia does it, maybe, you know, because there's just not much to show. But for countries that are kind of in the hunt here for coming out near the top, it's. I had a friend from New Zealand who always boasted that there are more medals per capita than anyone else. So if you just change the denominator, you're doing a lot better. But states seem to care about this. Polities seem to care. And then the potential to stigmatize, I think, is really important too. Delimiting what is unacceptable. And again, we do some watch lists, blacklists, etc. Then, when might we expect these GPAs to affect outcomes? You know, as I said, I don't think that anything that an NGO creates is going to have an impact on what states do. Creators need to be authoritative. And we can have, I think, a pretty deep discussion on what creates authority. But I think it has something to do with your legitimacy to judge. What creates that legitimacy to judge? I think it has something to do with your competence in it and whether you are considered kind of a good performer in the thing yourself and if you're fair. And I think those are the kinds of things that work their way into the idea of authority. I would add power in here too. We can have a conversation. Obviously, the more powerful states, it doesn't really constitute their authority, but it definitely, I think, makes their efforts to grade others to be even more potentially powerful. I think that when the informational opportunity structure is open, so in some areas there are a lot of indicators already in place, such, you know, the economic area, wow, there were already like 25 or 30. It's going to be hard to move the needle very much in that space. But to pick out something else that there really has not been too much attention to, and presumably that people still care about, there might be more room to have a bigger influence. So the informational opportunity structure, where there's contestation, there may be greater opportunity. This provides opportunities to name, to set standards, and to create new focal points. So potentially, I think, you know, sort of thinking about the kind of informational ecology, if you want to think about it that way, could also create openings for having big influences. Employing monitoring can be very helpful too. Because monitoring, some people will well know if you come from a more sociological tradition, is a means of social control. So even if you are not like literally doing something or punishing them, there is this potential for reactivity. That is, the monitor doing what they know they are expected to do. That's for whatever reason, because the monitor is respected, and the monitor has indicated that this is an important behavior, important enough to spend resources watching and gathering information. Oh, that's socially important. That's the right thing to do. Even before I know my ranking, I'm going to go ahead and respond to being monitored. Monitoring also creates repeat interactions. For these, especially with a lot of these, there's the expectation that they'll be back next year, or in 5 years, or down the road. And so this kind of monitoring relationship becomes quite iterative with state bureaucracies. And then, as I stressed again and again, I think these GPAs can affect outcome when they make explicit comparisons, which stimulates competition, provokes status concerns, and I think get states geared up to change their behavior. So these are just ways in which we can think about these GPAs mattering to people, to human beings, maybe to organizations. But the question is, again, how do they work their way through policy? And so this is just a schema here. But I was thinking about how GPA might end up going from creator to the target. Pathways might this go? So we can imagine a number of different creators, states. I mentioned the United States, intergovernmental organizations. The UN has plenty of GPAs. The World Bank has plenty of GPAs. Non-governmental organizations like Freedom House, private sector groups, some for-profit, that create these indicators. And they make their assessments. They choose what form to put them in, and sometimes it's a combination. It's a very sort of simple representation, not mutually exclusive here. And then these are going to start to feed into the way that decisions are made. They might work at the level of domestic politics. So it could be that when a state gets a really bad score on how they're trying to fight human trafficking from the United States government, it could well be that this sort of mobilizes non-governmental organizations and advocates domestically to say, we can do better than this. You've got to do a lot better. And this kind of helps, again, to pump up those demands via domestic politics. We can imagine civil society mobilization, citizen or firm pressure. So when you're out of the away from the world of human trafficking and into the world of the ease of doing business indicator, where the fewer regulations you have in place, the better you score. Who's going to be the lobby group for that? It's going to be firms. Okay, so that's another civil society actor who very well might mobilize and say, we can do better. Look, we need to get rid of a lot of these business regulations that just make it hard for us to work. So that could work through domestic politics. It can also work through elite politics, and I alluded to this because ministers care. Ministers care about their reputation. They feel that their professionalism might be on display and highly questioned if the ranking isn't very good. They are concerned about criticism of their peers in other countries. This is the kind of thing that can create a good deal of embarrassment. And then finally, transnational politics, as I was mentioning, the concern about the flows of foreign investments, perhaps, business, aid flows. So these have an influence, potentially, hypothesis, on target behavior. And then we can think of outcomes. And there are other outcomes than this. I mean, there are many outcomes you could look at in a very interesting way, like the effect on discourse, for example. But ultimately, and sort of simply, I'm thinking about legislative changes. I'm thinking about regulatory reforms and reprioritizing the kinds of things that the assessment regime is targeting and is bringing to the fore. So those are kind of my thoughts, just sort of in general about the concept, the theory. I have two things I want to talk about, but I want to stop for a minute because I want to invite you first to ask any questions you have. Yeah. Oh, are you?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Super interesting. Well, I thought, of course, immediately of sort of the index that had the most influence, at least from my perspective, in Germany. And I think that was clearly the PISA index, and so the ranking of school systems had a major influence on also German education policy. But I think the main reason why it had such an influence was that it actually went against the expectations.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So Germany really thinks it has a perfect school system, expected to be somewhere sort of at the top, but it turned out to be somewhere in the middle, even lower, lower middle. So this
sort of aspirational deficit opened up.
Yeah, in contrast to that, like indicators like ease of business, transparency, and things like this, they hardly make the news because Germany always ends up where you would be expected.
Yeah.
Right, so this makes me think about reputation isn't information, or the information that those indexes provide only really information as long as it, in one way or the other, goes against your existing expectations, your beliefs. And this makes me think of...
I think you're very right from the point of view of a state who thought they were doing well. I think that's absolutely right. But from the point of view of a state who's sort of down kind of in the middle, low to middle, And, you know, there's all kinds of things that could provoke the sense that we're not doing as well as we can do. One is that there's a gap between what you, how you performed and how you think you should perform. But there's another one, too, and that is, how did somebody you compete with all the time perform? So, you know, who are the kind of performance rivals on this? Think of those things. China and India are a good example.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's really about the expectations, and regardless of whether it's absolute indicators or competition, then it might just be the case that as a result of this, those who are at the bottom anyway, they might not care about being at the bottom anymore, right? They just expect to be doing really bad.
So
this competition can
affect it. Well, that, okay, I agree. I agree sort of with that. But there's also at least something we should keep in mind. There's a principle in psychology called last place aversion. And it's exactly what it sounds like. I do not want to be in last. You know, I've got to go up a little bit to stay from being the very bottom. So there's something even at the bottom that matters. But generally, the states at the bottom have very low capacity. You know, they usually are. You know, if you look at them, I'm sure that long-term political violence and almost all of these scales predicts that you do poorly in the bottom. And so I think that we have a real capacity problem there. One of the chapters in this edited volume we're doing noted that, which one was it? It was on the, I think it was Corruption Perceptions Index, tested to see whether there was any effect, because they noticed the media always reports the bottom 10 states and their performance. And they just, you know, again, they could really document this with how the reports came out. The bottom 10 countries are in this transparency index. And these scholars noted that the competition was taking place right around state number 10. So I think it's highly contextual. I think it's very, very complex.
But it's a different mechanism, right? If you,
it's all reputation. It's competition. It's status. It's I think it's all of these potential mechanisms, really. If you stay out of bottom 10, you know, maybe the domestic complaints won't be as bad because it doesn't even get in the press if you're not in the bottom 10.
But just as a follow-up, then, if it really matters that something goes into press and only something that is against your beliefs sort of makes the news, right? Then isn't there also room for strategic behavior on the part of those who actually compile those indexes, that they know they will only be really in the news if they sort of, if the ranking changes from year to year?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a good point. That's testable, by the way. You know, do these rankings that have more movement in them, ceteris paribus, do they get more attention? I suspect you're right. The other thing is, sometimes they don't present all new information, like on the PISA scores. The United States, we interviewed folks at the Department of Education. And on the PISA scores, this is an educational ranking system by the OECD. On the PISA scores, the United States, you know, when we interviewed folks at the Department of Education, they said, we already know everything that is in these courses. No new information. So there's no new policy advice or anything like that. What was useful for us was to be able, politically useful for us, was to be able to know how we were doing in comparison to our European peers. And that's what they found to be politically useful. So it depends on what even we mean by new information. There was no new policy content there. There was only the clear demonstration that the United States was lagging. So anyway, so I think we'll get to be really kind of open to thinking about a lot of different ways in which concerns and reputations and politics get triggered. And I'm going to guess it is contextual in the country.
Yeah. Let's take a question back here and then over here.
I think of my favorite example, which is I was living in Argentina in the October of 2001 when they were about to default on their national debt. And you know how in newspapers they often have the weather up in the upper right corner? They had the weather and they had the country risk number every day. Those numbers up there. But I have some questions that I suppose are inspired by reading and thinking about private governance which this is clearly related to in some way. You talked about how states might contest with each other, but I was wondering if you find any evidence that these rating systems contest with each other. And if you have a way of thinking about that or if that's important to you. And then just another question.
Let's start with that one first. Unless the next one is just more of the same question. No.
That's a different question.
So I think that's very true. One thing when we did this series of interviews, we asked them explicitly, what are the cognate measures that you think you're the most similar to? And, you know, a lot of them definitely this, and, well, you know, range of these, and, you know, and now we have a database for thinking about who the GPAs think they are competing with. Good. And I think the idea of this that came out in this sort of last back and forth about, you know, competing for attention themselves is another potential way to go. I guess I feel like that's an interesting but slightly second order question, because I don't really know if it matters in the world of what states end up doing with their resources. You know, that's why I want to kind of make sure, I want to do a reality check sort of there, and then sort of dig down and say, well, that's interesting, so let's find out more about the processes that kind of end up nudging, if they do, nudging. Now, what was your second?
Well, the second one was, I recently reviewed Jessica Green's book on private governance, made up, so I'm thinking about all these issues, but, you know, one of her categories of private governance that's essentially delegated from states.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you ever found that kind of times that states asked non-state actors to create these kinds of ratings.
Some of them ask, may we participate? The PISA, again, is an example of this. Some states, now remember, the PISA is sort of embarrassing, but it's also a political tool to say we need to do more for education. And so we found that some countries said, please, we would like to be PISA rated too. You know, started in the OECD, but several other countries from the outside wanted to be in it as well, because they wanted to be, you know, there were actors within those countries who had interests in having this as a tool to influence and to change the discourse around education in their own countries. So sometimes they want to be, and they're saying, take us too, we want to be rated. Other times there's strong resistance to this form of delegation, and I will give you two examples. China does not like the ease of doing business indicators. They resisted them from the beginning. This idea of deregulation did not fit their model of the economy and their model of government-private relationships and what governments ought to be doing. They resisted it from the beginning. They said, we make it easier in other ways, but not in those ways for governments to do business, and they resisted. They pushed back publicly, and you know, they made a big deal out of it. There's a lot in The Economist about China resisting. There's also been a lot of resistance to the United States grading countries on their human trafficking as well. Okay, sure. So, you know, they just don't like it. And it's this universe, like, why you? Why do you get to do this? You know? I think, you know, if we wanted to think a little bit more, too, about legitimacy, I would guess that an international organization maybe has a little more legitimacy than a single state running around the world doing it. Mm-hmm. Hypothesis. I don't even know how to measure that, by the way. But it strikes me that that's very possible.
Question?
Yes.
Yes, you're already very comprehensive.
You guys should introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. I'm Marie Thorsten. I teach in Japan, and I'm CIS fellow here this year. So I was wondering, you're already very comprehensive, but I haven't heard you mention any effect on education, especially, or not just the PISA thing, but how the pedagogy or curriculum of international relations is taught. Are there any effects on that?
I don't know why I haven't said anything about that. No, I really don't know how it's affected.
Well, what came to my mind, if I use, are you considering like CIE World Factbook as part of a GPA?
No.
No? Okay, something like that. But when I use data in my class like that, students fall into that trap, what you just mentioned, of simplifying complex reality or making some kind of social judgment. They just make their little pie charts and they say, oh, this country is lazy, or things like that. So I really discovered the need to teach narrative and discourse and things like that, you know, at the same time that they're using data. And also, it's very interdisciplinary when we bring in these, you know, school and education factors and social factors. I think students are often surprised that that these things can be taken as international policy. So I was wondering if you have, basically, you don't have any.
For IR, maybe I misunderstood you. For IR curriculum?
Yeah, right. So if I'm teaching international relations, the students tend to really start use, you know, stereotyping narrative when they're discussing data. So that just causes me to rethink my approach on how I teach. And I was wondering if you found anything similar to that.
I have not in the classroom.
Yeah, right. Or just the way that international relations is taught.
You want to think about that? I'll ask you. Or Jeff, you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, there is more. We're just pausing.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will.
So I was thinking about, we're sort of moving in the direction of, and sometimes talking about whose purpose these agencies are serving, these GPAs are serving. We talked about how a large proportion of them are Western-based, maybe even Anglo-American-based. And it made me thinking about the extent to which this is actually, you know, a Western political project as opposed to a global political project. You mentioned the pushback from China. And then you kept emphasizing again and again that these things are important, you think, because they stimulate comparison, create competition, and so on. And it made me wonder whether you thought yet about the extent to which, where this type of competition is racing us towards, right? So are we moving to the top? Is it a race to the top in terms of improving standards? Is it a race to the bottom, you know, in terms of, you mentioned, deregulation and liberalization? And to how does this then feedback about in terms of questions about legitimacy to judge? Do you emphasize how legitimacy to judge is important in terms of the authority of these organizations? So obviously, if you question this is a particular normative project of some actor, that's going to damage the authority of that particular agency.
So you got a lot there. May I?
Yeah, one small empirical suggestion. Then, yeah. Please.
Okay, so where's this leading? Where's it going?
Exactly.
So first of all, let me stress, we don't know. We cannot prove, right? I'll show you some evidence. You tell me how strong you think the evidence is. I don't think it bowls me over. But it is highly suggestive that these measures are nudging in the direction that they are intended to nudge states towards, with a couple of perverse examples I'll give you. But my hypothesis is that they're moving towards whatever it is that the highly salient, highly authoritative, highly visible, highly competitive ranking systems are asking these states to do. So that's some of it you might like. Right? If you like deregulation, you're going to love the ease of doing business indicators. You're going to love it. If you like criminalization as an approach to human trafficking, you're going to love the United States rating system, its tier system. Now, if you love other things, and again, you could go back to the palm trees and pull one across that you like the most and see who's doing the best. But it depends on what it is that the indicators are trying to do, some of which might take us into a better world, some of which is not going to take us into a better world, if they're even effective at all. What is the end point? I think that if there's a little bit dialectical, if you don't mind me saying something like that, and that is when you get to a point where the indicator has had some effects or has changed policy sufficiently, and now many of the downsides of racing in that direction become obvious, there are going to be new indicators. So there's going to be sort of a branch off. There's going to be sort of new indicators that I think are going to maybe take a similar strategy but try to replace the previous one, or might take a different strategy completely. But it strikes me that that's where contestation is going to come in when it becomes believed that the indicators mattered in a certain way, and it becomes increasingly clear to some people anyway that the consequences might not be as positive as we.
Yeah, that was my quick second follow-up question, which is about legitimacy. Do you have a sense of what proportion of these GPAs actually survive?
Yes.
You had that nice graph going up, but some of them must die, right?
The dead ones are on there, actually. The dead ones that we could find are on there. That's very tricky. You might have to go back. Okay, you can't We found some on that were still sort of hanging around on the internet. They're gray here. We found them that we saw reference to them. We kind of felt like they had existed at one point, but they had not been updated like in 5 years or something like that. And so we put them in the dead category. We don't know very much about them though, because they haven't been very updated, and we don't know as much about them as we do about the ones with the middle bars. But we should be able to find out who created them. And I think two hypotheses about the dead and dying would be, first of all, that they are created by non-governmental organizations that themselves go out of business. NGOs come and go too. And so they might have created them for a few years, and now the organization is gone. They can't create the index anymore. And another possibility, I guess, might be that they just didn't have the resources to carry on, and they weren't having any impact. And so why continue? There might be a lot more gray than we can find, though. But there might have been these things back in the 70s, and we can't see them because we don't have internet traces in the same way. So we have a little bit of a problem there with this graph. It's not very surprising that we can see more gray, kind of from 95 on. But this is what we can see. This is what we can get traces of by looking around the internet.
So I have a question. The problem is we have like a choice point here. We've got 10 minutes or a little less to work with. So I can hold my...
Okay.
Yeah, so I can hold my question, or I can ask my question. I don't know whether you can do the cases that fast, so whether we're just going to, so maybe we should continue the conversation.
Let me just ask you this. If you could hear something about the ease of doing business indicators or the trafficking in persons report, how many people would prefer the ease of doing business indicators? How many people would prefer that human trafficking? What do you think? Not even?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm just going to do the human trafficking one because it's right here. But anyway, so the U.S. uses this tip report to try to influence countries' policies on human trafficking. And this is how the system works, okay? So this is how the U.S. produces this information. They create a report. Either you're in the report or you're not, and then they put you in these tiers. You are good. You're okay. Watch out. You're getting worse, and we don't like what you're doing. You're very bad. And by the way, if you're very bad, you're potentially subject to sanction, but just the truth in advertising, it never happens. The only ones who ever get sanctioned have already been sanctioned: North Korea, Iran, Cuba, etc. Okay, although the latter one is obviously going to be changing because Iran's changing as well. But anyway, so sanctioning is not really an option here. So what we have here is that the number of countries are in the report that increases over time. So we can actually do a comparison of before and after during the report. That's very handy with this data. And we can look at the prime thing the U.S. is trying to get countries to do, to criminalize human trafficking. The U.S. takes a very prosecutorial law enforcement approach to human trafficking. And there are other policy alternatives that are out there. These are the pathways to influence that I think work, may be operative in this issue area, that it's a state who started it. It works through creating these categories, these tier categories. I think potentially all of these mechanisms are there. I think professional criticism and civil society is probably the most likely, and the outcome is legislative change. Changing your criminal statutes. Okay, so that sort of gives away to think about this influence. If you don't think the U.S. cares about human trafficking very much, it is in the WikiLeaks, and these would be non-classified WikiLeaks here. So you can see it's a big, big deal. The U.S. talks about, with embassies around the world a lot, about trafficking and human trafficking, labor trafficking, children trafficking, etc., etc. Okay, so that just sort of gives us a sense of how important this is to the U.S. We have some very key findings that when you're included in the report, it's pretty much because you're bad. So we already know that, and we can control for it. So selection into the report, we control for. But why does the U.S. then decide to give some states a low-tier score? Mostly driven by factors that are not associated with a greater likelihood of criminalizing. So it's not just that they would have criminalized anyway, okay? Because we did a pre-check to see that's not what's driving what's going on here. The most important and interesting thing here is that controlling for other key relevant factors of criminalization was spurred by inclusion in the report, a monitoring effect. Monitoring. We are now watching. We are now collecting information. And also by harsher tier ratings, we found that the harsher your tier rating, the more likely you were in the next year to criminalize. That's pretty embarrassing, I think. And very interestingly, to get to this point about, you know, what is it exactly that triggers? Is it the rating, or the change, or the expectation, or what is it? Downgrades mattered a lot, too. And they would start in one tier, and then they would downgrade it for not making much effort, or making less effort than they were. Then the U.S. would downgrade them, and then they were more likely to criminalize to try to pop their scores back. Just an interesting example. There's no time really to get into the second case study, but there's just one thing that I want to mention, and that it's very hard to show that the ease of doing business indicators affect what states do. They might just be trying to improve their business environment, right? That's the alternative hypothesis. The null is sort of that they just wanted to do this. So we looked at states that had created reform committees. Reform committees are ones that work closely with the World Bank to decide what package of reforms to put into place. Okay? And then the state, you know, takes out everybody and they decide what to do. We found something really very interesting. We found that that for states that had made reform committees had a different outcome with respect to their scores than those who did not. For every reform taken across these two groups, if you have a reform committee, you went up higher in the ratings. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? You learned what it takes, what reforms to take to improve your score. Let me give you very quickly an analogy because I was just thinking about this. Undergraduates, graduate students, what are you, undergrad? So you form study groups sometimes, and do you have exam reviews? Maybe sometimes with a teaching assistant.
Yeah, maybe the year after.
Great, that's analogous. That's analogous to these reform committees. You have two choices when you study. You can study on your own and just do your best, go through all the lectures, do all the reading, look over the notes, maybe do a little research if you're really good and motivated. That's what you can do, or you can go to a study session with your teaching assistant. I'm guessing that per hour attending, per hour studying, you are going to score better on the exam in the room with your teaching assistant. Why? You will learn what is on the test. You will learn what is on the test. You're not trying to cheat. They're trying to guide and be helpful, right? They're trying to answer questions. And students figure out what it takes. I'm going to guess that that is what happens when you study with other students with a teaching assistant there. That's what the reform committees do.
Well, that's why we don't tell the teaching assistants what we're going to put on the examination.
Let me just put it this way. At Harvard, they know. At Harvard, they know. Okay? I don't know Penn yet. I haven't taught an undergraduate course yet. They definitely know. Thank you. Point made, right? It's teaching to the exam. And my point is, for the same amount of effort, you know what puts up your grade, which makes you a strategic studier, which is very similar to what will improve my ease of doing business score, which reforms do I have to take? Which ones will improve my score the most? Anyway, I just thought I'd end with that little bit of an analogy and take any more questions.
Well, we maybe have time for...
Aren't you going to tell us the results of the survey?
Oh my goodness, yes.
So let's do that and then we'll call it action. We do make those previous year exams available, so it has the same kind of effect. Unless you assume that the faculty people teaching their course and come up with an entirely different question.
So, So, do the rankings influence investment? So, imagine you're a senior executive, blah, blah, blah. This is what you've got. Right? Tell me if you got this. Tell me if you didn't get this. You didn't, right? You got what?
There's a different ranking.
There's a different ranking. So half of you randomly got 130, and half of you randomly got rated 30. Okay? The information about this. So I quickly, everything else is even bigger, right? So I quickly popped these into, now this is small, these are small numbers, I'm not, but it's interesting, is it not, that that practically, if you have a ease of doing business ranking of 130, you know, very likely would be there's nobody who got a ranking of 30 who put unlikely to invest, somewhat unlikely, or neither one. Always the top categories. But that's not true with people who got 130. And everything else was all constant. So, interesting. So
good group, bad group?
No, a group that takes information into account.
Yeah.
Right? That's what this group did. You made a shortcut. That's okay. That's actually, we've done this on InTurk as well, and we're going to be doing it on some actual investment bankers and see if we can save results.
So that, thanks. This is great. I think we give you a pretty high performance score. and thanks so much for coming. It's really appreciated.